Mr. Mason, reel two. Can you tell me about the situation on the beaches near Dunkirk? Because some people allege that some people were badly behaved and officers let down their men and so on. Did you see anything of that?
Well, I wouldn't say anyone was badly behaved. In fact, I thought it was all very orderly. The one thing I did feel that the officers were, the army officers anyway, were certainly not in command. Units were split up, and the chain of command obviously had been broken. And for most of the troops, they relied, I think, more on the Navy than they did on the officers. Perhaps if they'd been their own officers, and the officers had had their senior NCOs with them, probably better order could have been maintained. But I think the soldiers kept their own order and their own discipline without being ordered about or being told what to do. And they waited pretty patiently, very patiently, to be taken off. Now and again, German aircraft would machine gun the beach and the woods behind, but I can't honestly say I saw very many casualties. I think it's true to say, I know the RAF were maligned at the time, but the RAF were keeping off German aircraft attacks from further away, that they didn't really have too much of a chance of getting to us. And although, as you probably know, after Dunkirk, the RAF were insulted at every turn because the soldiers thought that they'd been let down, but I don't think that was true at all. In fact, we know it isn't true now.
Did you feel aggrieved about the RAF at the time?
I don't think I did. I don't think I felt aggrieved at all. On one occasion, I did see a Hurricane shot down by our own Bofors guns, which were right beside us. The Hurricane was hit in the tail and managed to get down and land just at the water's edge, fortunately away from the queues. I think a sergeant pilot got out of it, I'm not sure. We were some way away from it by then. The guns went off, well, sporadically. There didn't seem to be a lot of targets for them. I expected on that beach to be bombed and shelled by the Germans, you know, because they were fairly close. And I suppose they could have shelled us all, but why they didn't, nobody knows. Well, it's history now that so few people were killed on the beaches. Anyway, I was there. I didn't join one of the queues. I stayed with the same two other signals chaps, and we stayed up in the dunes. We'd managed to find some water and a tin of bully and some biscuits, and we were quite happy.
Why didn't you join the queues?
Well, I've always hated queues, and I thought, well, they were so long, they didn't see any chance of any of us getting away, really. At least not those at the end of the queue. And these lifeboats which kept coming in, they didn't seem to be taking many people away, and the queues seemed to get just longer and longer. And finally that night, or at dusk, I should say, most of the soldiers had got away. Most of them were left on the beach had got away. So there were just comparatively few of us left, but no lifeboats coming in again. So we stood at the water's edge, and then we saw a lifeboat coming in towards us. And I took my trousers off and wrapped them round my neck. I had my respirator. I'd still got my rifle and a tin hat. And then the lifeboat came towards us. We clambered in. There was no particular rush. And the petty officer, I think, said, right, four of you take over the oars. My blokes are exhausted. So four of us, who'd perhaps done a bit of rowing before I had, took hold of one of the great sweeps for this lifeboat and turned it and rowed back out to sea quite a long way. And by this time it was really dusk. And I suppose the ships had come back in again, you see, because of the light going. It couldn't be seen so well. So we got to the side of this ship. It was a destroyer. And all got to the companionway. And all of the chaps, we were still holding on to the oars, and all the chaps got off, including the sailors. And a voice shouted down to us, right, row that boat back to the beach and pick up anybody else you see. So we rowed back to the beach, but we didn't see anyone. There seemed to be nobody left on the beach at all. I think this was the night of the 2nd of June, as far as I remember, which was quite late for the evacuation, so whether they'd all gone or not, I don't know. No one else appeared. We saw that there was no one on the beach to be picked up, and we turned the lifeboat with some difficulty. The sea was very calm, fortunately. We were so lucky there. And rowed like mad back to where we thought the destroyer was. By this time it was quite dark. Oh, one thing I'd done when this chap had said, right, row it back to the beach, so there was a sailor at the bottom of the companionway, and I threw my trousers at him and I said, hang those somewhere where I can see them when I come back, you see. So back we went, rowed back to the destroyer and couldn't see it at all. It was pitch black. And we thought, oh, you know, we've had it. And then suddenly we heard the engines roar somewhere else, and we shouted like mad. And the engines slowed down, and then we could see out of the darkness the side of the ship. And sure enough, we found the same ship, and it was the destroyer Worcester. So the order was, let it go, let the lifeboat go, don't want that anymore. So the four of us dashed up the companionway feeling, you know, very happy at being rescued.
Was the ship packed out?
Oh, absolutely packed, yes. And my faithful rifle I still had with me. I'd take that into the lifeboat with me. And I clambered aboard with it and then started to try to find my trousers. They were, of course, nowhere in sight. The ship was absolutely seething. Anyway, I found a place on deck and settled down, and then the ship started. And I believe, I'm not sure, there was a terrible jolting went on, that it actually hit a sandbank, actually grounded for a time on this sandbank, and then managed to clear it, and off we went at fairly high speed, presumably towards England. Well, it was towards England.
You were on the upper deck, were you?
I was on the upper deck, yes.
What condition were you in?
All tired, but quite happy, very happy. Hungry, but, quite happy. Pleased to be on the ship. I was a bit worried about my rifle. This is the old regular soldier's feeling. It was so filthy, full of sand. I thought, somebody's going to catch me when I get ashore, and they're going to have me for having a dirty rifle. You know, these are the sort of silly things you think about. Anyway, finally, at dawn, it pulled into Dover Dock, and on the shore I could see ambulances and nurses, ATS, great gathering there waiting for the wounded and so on to come ashore. And my only feeling was that I should have to walk ashore in my underpants, rather dirty underpants. But as I shuffled towards the gangway leading up to the dockside, I found my trousers hanging on a wire just as I passed by. And of course I was delighted to find those, and I soon hopped into those. Walked up the gangway there, and as soon as my feet touched the ground, a military police sergeant said, "Oh, you brought your rifle back, son? Oh, good lad, put it on that heap over there." Which I did. Of course, I never saw it again. I suppose it was taken back and cleaned up and reissued, you see. Well, then we were put on a train, and our first stop was Derby. Well, no, not the first stop. We stopped at various stations, and of course, we had all this business of the local people coming out, you know, with tea and sandwiches and cigarettes and... whilst we felt, or I at least felt, thoroughly ashamed to come back to England in that state as a defeated army, every station that we stopped for food and that sort of thing, the people seemed to be delighted. They seemed to think they were welcoming home a bunch of heroes, and we certainly didn't feel like that, I can tell you. Anyway, we detrained at Derby, and we were driven out in trucks to a field outside Derby. There we stayed for a few days, and of course the talk was then of invasion, and if it had come, goodness knows what would have happened. I think there were 2,000 or 3,000 people in that field. They'd hastily put up tents, set up field kitchens, and gradually they sorted us out, and after a time of a lot of train travel up and down the country, I eventually found my unit, the three of us. We'd stuck together all this time. The three of us had found our unit in Fovant in Wiltshire, and there we joined the regiment again. And of course we'd been posted as missing, and they seemed quite pleased to find that we'd turned up. Out of the section, one man had been killed and one was missing, believed taken prisoner. So really that was the Dunkirk episode. One of the strange things that happened when I went to a Dunkirk reunion, that was the 40th reunion, I was walking around Le Pan Cemetery, and I saw on one of the gravestones a signals badge, walked over to see perhaps if it was anyone I knew, and found that the man's number was, his army number was one below mine. So he must have joined up virtually on the same day. Same age as me, 19 at the time, and he'd been killed at Le Pan. I never knew him, or at least I never remembered him. I've got a photograph of his grave, actually.
When you were with the BEF in France, what kind of relationship did you and the other soldiers have with the French population?
Well, we didn't see very much of the French population. They seemed to be quite friendly in the villages. I think the atmosphere with the British and the French is exactly the same today as it was then. They think we're a bit odd, and I suppose mainly the British think the French are a bit odd. It's difficult to say about our relationship with the French. There's always been that little bit of, I don't know, old enemies, I suppose, from the past, which... you know, history being what it is, we've never been bosom pals with the French. I can't think why not. when we go on holiday today, we find them very nice indeed, charming people. They seem to like us. And yet other people have quite a different impression of the French somehow.
Can we jump ahead in the war and come on to the SOE and tell me how you came to be in there?
Yes. Well, now, I stayed with this unit for some time in England, and the regiment was posted all over the country supporting various divisions. This is the idea, going back to what I said about medium regiments and divisions. So we all seemed to be on the move, and finally we'd been north, south, everywhere. Finally at Charing in Kent, I'd just been promoted to Lance Corporal and had a motorcycle accident which damaged my knee. And shortly after that I came on leave and finished up in the local hospital in Weston-sur-Mer, the military hospital, which was on the seafront. And the night I arrived was the night that Weston had its biggest air raid. The place next door was destroyed and so on. I finally finished up at a hospital near Bristol, a place called Winford, and my knee, which had been damaged, was drained and that sort of thing. And then I was posted to back to a Royal Signals depot in Kirkburton in Yorkshire. And of course, there again, being more than 21 days adrift, my place had been filled back at the regiment, or back at the signal section, which upset me terribly at the time, because you lose all your friends. We were a very close-knit community, only 30 of us in a section, signal section. So once again, I was posted, but at the depot, they discovered that I was I suppose what they would call a well-trained signalman or lance corporal. And I was promoted corporal at the depot and posted to a new signal section, again attached to artillery. And then I was made lance sergeant and posted with this section to a field regiment in Northumberland. To the 15th Scottish Division. And of course my only hope and wish was to get away. I wanted to get abroad, you see. I wanted to get away from this dull training, which went on all the time, you see. Most of us were bored to tears with it, especially in winter, especially in Northumberland. So I'd volunteered for many things. I'd volunteered for the paratroops. I'd even volunteered to be an air gunner in the RAF, a transfer, at one stage. I volunteered for the commandos, but each time I put the request in, I was turned down by the CO for obvious reasons. No, you're too well trained for us to get rid of you. You've got to stay, you see. And then finally, this signal came through which said volunteers required for paramilitary operations. I think that's about all it said. And I put my name in, and to my surprise, the very next day I was called in to Alnwick, which was the headquarters of our signals division. And the CO tried to stop me going, and he said, unfortunately, this has come from Corps, and there's nothing I can do to stop you going. So he said, I've got to forward your name. And he was not very happy. So he gave me a railway warrant and said, you will get the 6 o'clock train from Carlisle, go back and pack your gear, your kit, take the 6 o'clock train to Carlisle, and get off the train at Oxford Station. And I said, and what do I do at Oxford, sir? He said, you volunteered for this lot. He said, you bloody find out. That was his remark.
When was this?
This was May 43. Must have been May 43.
And did you have much conception of what paramilitary operations meant?
I had no idea. Paramilitary meant nothing to me at the time. I spoke to one of our chaps, when I got back and said, I've been accepted for this lot, I said, what do you think it means? He said, well, it was bound to be something to do with parachuting. Well, it was, but of course paramilitary's got nothing to do with that. But it was rather an odd thing, wasn't it? But anyway, anything to get away from this training, and hopefully to get out of England. And so when I got to Oxford, at about 3 a.m, I suppose, got off the train, I saw 2 other soldiers get off the train further up the platform. The train pulled out, and there we were, knowing nothing at all. Then, out of the gloom, an officer approached me, what's your name? Told him, wait there. Went to the next person, same thing, and to the further one, the furthest one, and then brought the first one, and the 3 of us joined up. He was our officer, a captain in the Royal Artillery. The other fellow was a corporal of the Royal Signals from the same division, although I didn't know him, and me. We were taken out to the station yard, put into the back of a 1,500-weight truck. The canvas curtains were pulled down, and the officer said, do not speak to one another, and do not try and look out of the back. I think there was a military policeman in there with us. So we were driven away, and after about 15 minutes, we stopped at a gate. There was murmurings going on. Gates opened, and we went through, and then there was a further gate. We stopped there. And then we were told to get out of the truck, and we were in front of an enormous country mansion, which I think was, I'm not sure, but I think it was Headington Hall. I know it was on the Headington Road out of Oxford, about 1.5 miles, perhaps 2 miles out of Oxford. We were taken in, given breakfast, the 3 of us, and the 3 of us were then taken to a room, beds in the room, and we were told to undress, we'd be called, go to bed, we'd be called at 10 a.m, something like that. When we were called, we went down for another breakfast, and we found that perhaps 50 officers and mainly signals people were assembled. And during the next 2 days, we were interviewed by various people. Why did we want to go into this sort of business, and did we realise what it was all about? And of course, we didn't. And we were medically inspected, a brief one, as far as I remember. The wireless operators were trade tested to see that they knew their Morse and what they knew about radio and that sort of thing. And I think it was on the 3rd evening I was called into the officer who seemed to be in charge and said that I would be accepted into special operations. I should be sent for training in the Middle East and would be probably parachuted into one of the Balkan countries. I was told that I should be working outside the international law, you know, concerning soldiers and that sort of thing. And the only thing I could expect if I was caught would be a bullet in the back of the head. I was asked if I wanted to continue or whether I would withdraw. And I said, no, I would carry on.
Why did you say that?
Well, I didn't fancy going back to Northumberland, because I don't think the colonel would have liked me very much to see me going back there. He'd probably put a bullet into my head anyway. We didn't leave on the best of friends, I can tell you. He was very upset about me leaving, disloyal to the unit, or sort of disloyalty to the unit. So I said I'd stick, and so that was it. I had to sign the Official Secrets Act, and of course in those days at the bottom it said penalty, death, you know, didn't mess about in those days. Signed the Official Secrets Act, and then I was given a railway warrant pass, and told I could go home for 7 days, maximum embarkation leave, to say nothing to any one of my friends or my family, what I was doing, where I was going. All I could say was that for the next few months, I didn't know how long, I couldn't write letters to them. They could write to me, but I couldn't reply. They'd have to put up with it. And so, after the 7 days, we went to London. We assembled north of Baker Street, Marylebone. And then we were kitted out at the Great Eastern Hotel, I think that's Marylebone. And within a few days we were on a ship from Southampton to the Middle East in convoy. Quite a quick convoy, I think that was. And we then got to Port Suez. We were put on a train to Cairo.
When you say we, who was...
Well, there were about, I suppose, 20 operators, wireless operators, and perhaps 20 or 30 officers, all volunteers, in this party.
Do you remember the names of any of them?
I remember the name only of one wireless operator, and that was... the chap that was with me, Corporal Henderson, and a Sergeant Huxtable. We made him a Corporal Huxtable, Sergeant Huxtable. Those were people I knew. I knew none of the others. No, no one.
What date have you reached now when you arrived in Egypt? About?
That's in my book. Oh, here we are. I've got here the 15th of July, 43. That's right, 15th of July, 43. So it was from there, the headquarters at Rustam Buildings in Cairo. And then, as far as I know, virtually all of us were put on a train after a day or two and sent to Haifa.
What do you remember about the headquarters at Rustam Buildings?
Well, on my first visit, very little. It was a huge block. I don't know whether it was a block of flats or offices. Hundreds of people running around there, I must say. Dozens of people were in each office, you know, all busily doing something. I don't quite know what they were all doing. Those are the ones we used to call the gabardine swine. I don't know if you heard that expression.
Yes.
All had their little jobs and their little offices. Don't remember too much about it on that occasion. I know it was the headquarters. But we were very quickly sent to, as I say, Palestine as it was then. And our training place was at Mount Carmel, above Haifa. I think it was an old police barracks. And here we did some training on explosives and weapons, various foreign weapons, Italian machine guns.